the Strait of Hormuz amid escalating tensions with Iran. Iran has seized a series of ships in the strait since 2019, following former President Trump's withdrawal from a landmark nuclear treaty. 20% of the world's crude oil supplies pass through the Strait of Hormuz. Officials, cited anonymously by the Associated Press and Washington Post, have stressed that no final decision had been made to station troops on commercial ships. The officials said discussions are underway between the U.S. and its Arab allies. The reports come as thousands of U.S. Marines aboard two ships are sailing towards the Persian Gulf, and others were flown to Bahrain for training. In domestic news, the College Board organization is recommending that schools in Florida shouldn't offer its AP course in psychology, citing state rules barring content about sexual orientation and gender identity. In a statement released yesterday, the College Board said Florida effectively banned the psychology course by making teaching about sex and gender, quote, illegal under state law. The State Department of Education claimed it had not banned the course and said the College Board is, quote, playing games with Florida students. The American Psychological Association said Florida's rules amount to censorship and would mean students, quote, receive an incomplete picture of the psychological research into human development. The U.S. economy added 187,000 new jobs last month, and the headline unemployment rate dipped to 3.5%. The Labor Department job numbers are slightly lower than the 200,000 jobs economists had predicted to see in July, but they still signal resilience in the labor market despite an historic series of Federal Reserve interest rate hikes in the past year. Federal Reserve policymakers have been attempting a so-called soft landing, in which interest rate hikes quell inflation but don't push the economy into recession. Today's data is a sign that a soft landing is still possible. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 74 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 75 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
All right, and the time now is 2 minutes past 3 p.m. Stay tuned for an expanded edition of Live on the Fly with Randy Credico here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
The Iraq War, famously, is a result of lies. Wars in Somalia are a result of lies. The Second World War and the German invasion of Poland was a result of carefully constructed lies. That is war by media. Let us ask ourselves, of the complicit media, which is the majority of the mainstream press, what is the average death count attributed to each journalist?
That was a quick exit. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly. That was, of course, Julian Assange at Trafalgar Square back in 2010 at a anti-war rally. Today is our seventh year doing Assange Countdown to Freedom. Our seventh year here. It started out. We're going to play a clip of our first interview with him later on in the show. But I got the greatest group of human rights crusaders in one show since The Last Supper. Seriously, I have such an incredible show today. If everybody gets online or if they call up, if they can't get online, they do have that number. As I said, this is WBAI, WBAI.org, sitting here with Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson, I just saw that yellow
Jackson,
shirt. It looks like an
Jackson.
Johnson. It looks like, it does look
really?
Like an Oakland A shirt, okay? I'm a little...
Really?
All right.
At this point in time, really?
Yes, I've done that. I'm sorry. Am I going to spend 10 minutes?
No, we're not going to spend 10 minutes on that. You got a show to do. Focus
on
that.
All right. So I want to thank Dr. Groner because Sophia is in the room today as well. You folks up at VSRS are miracle workers. I can't believe that she's here today. All right. So we have, before I play a little transition music, we do have people from around the world from Argentina. We're going to have the former ambassador from Argentina to UK, close friend to Julian Assange. We have from Scotland, from Edinburgh, the human rights crusader, the writer, the journalist, and a dear friend of mine, Craig Murray. And then we have Julian Assange's father. Murray is in Scotland, and Julian's father, John Shipton, not Jackson, is in Oz. Oz, which is Australia. And who else do we have? Well, we have Ray McGovern from Bumpluck, North Carolina, and from the bright side of the moon, we have Roger Waters joining us. So he's going to co-host if he gets connected here. So
he actually is connected.
He's connected. All right, so let's just play. Now, folks, I've been playing for the last year and a half Russian music because nobody else will in this country. So I love it. Here's a little Shostakovich. We'll come back with Roger Waters and Craig Murray to start off this show. Okay? That calm me down. I know it's not up music, but
are you sure about that, Randy?
I'm up. I'm calmed down. All right.
You sure?
It's hot
in
here.
You can do a show.
I'm going to do a show.
You're going to do a show.
All right. All right. Okay. So we are back here at WBAI, and let me get right to it. I want to make sure that he's there. Music icon and, of course, activist icon Roger Waters joins us from the bright side of the moon. Welcome, Roger.
Thank you, Randy.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right.
Are you? All right. It's good to have you on. Thank you. I certainly... Reggie is laughing.
Why?
Why is Reggie laughing?
I'll tell you why Reggie's laughing. Because as far as the great... whatever it is out there is concerned, you are junk. And that is where you go, in my mail, which is why I never get your... I found it, obviously, because I could have been Sherlock Holmes in another life. And so I figured out, where the F are they going? And I thought, junk. It only took me about 10 minutes.
And Craig Murray is Dr. Watson. Dr. Watson, are you there? Do we have Craig Murray?
Yeah, he's there.
All right. You Craig. Gentlemen, we have not had together on the same show since I think it had something to do with the French Revolution. You both hopefully have found your three-volume sets of Thomas Carlyle's History of the French Revolution. Craig, have you found yours?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Okay.
I've got mine.
All right. All right. So listen, we have what I want to do. Obviously, we have John Shipton. We're going to put him on in a few minutes as well. Is this? I want to be a fly on the wall, and this is kind of an open discussion. As we know, I think we're at that point where we think that it's imminent that Julian will be extradited to the U.S. And so I've put this roundtable together to see what we can do and. What you feel about it, Craig, is it imminent?
It could be. I mean, it's very hard to tell. From what we've seen so far, I've lost any belief whatsoever in the independence of the judiciary in the UK, any belief that there's any kind of fair hearing in process. So we could see a situation where his final appeal at the High Court is dismissed very quickly, very rapidly, and he's then bundled onto a flight the next day before he can appeal to the Supreme Court or before there can be any stopping injunction from the European Court of Human Rights. So it could end up being very imminent indeed. On the other hand, they could continue to do what we've done for years, which is procrastinate and put it off and wait another year till the next hearing and potentially even bump it through till after the next US presidential election, which to some extent might, you know, remove a possible embarrassment for Biden. But if you ask me to bet on either of those, I think the signs I'm picking up are that it's more likely to be imminent than to be delayed.
And that's why you're coming to this country in the next month. At least it's pending. Let's hope that you have to call off that trip to the U.S. How do you feel about this, Roger? Do you feel that it's imminent yourself? Are we at that point that you're pessimistic?
Well, first of all, Craig, it's really lovely to hear your voice again, mate. And I always listen very carefully to everything you have to say because you are one of the wise men. I hope you're wrong about the imminence of Julian Assange's departure for the United States. When you were telling us just a few moments ago, the little voice inside my head was going, how did they get away with it? But that's a little voice, actually it's quite a big voice, that is there inside my head 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is me asking myself, how did they get away with it? How, and Craig says he's lost any faith at all in the judicial system in the United Kingdom. Well, so have I, because how did they get away with it, Craig? Perhaps you can answer me this as well. Is it because of the connivance of the mainstream media in this country? We know it's partly because of the connivance of the whole of what I call the ruling class, and you probably do as well, because Julian Assange is extreme. In fact, any journalist who does his job is a great inconvenience to the ruling class. Because they need we, the people, the electorate, the general population, the public, to be kept absolutely ignorant of what they do and what they do in the name of what they call democracy or freedom or liberty or justice or the law. And in this case, it's what they do in terms of the law. So what we were all saying a few weeks ago, when I was actually performing in London at the time, when Jonathan Swift, his lordship or justice or whatever the F his name is or whatever his title is, came out with his three-page long denial of all the eminently reasonable grounds for appeal provided by his legal counsel, all of them. Not least that the fact that the High Court in London looked as if it's on the brink of sending Julian Assange across the Atlantic Ocean to certain death at the hands of the American Empire. What a very extreme thing to say on the radio, Roger. How could you? What makes you think that? We have evidence that on the face of it seems fairly indisputable that they, the American Empire, have been planning or had been planning to assassinate Julian Assange, the CIA I'm talking about now, before he went to political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And we the Brits, we the people of England, are conspiring with the Jonathan Swifts of this world and, of course, the government, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, and it was his name, Rishi Karnak. Is that his name, the Prime Minister? Something like that. Sunak. Yeah, thank you. But they're following the lead of the late Prime Minister. Well, he's not dead yet, Boris Johnson, but the bloke who used to be prime minister before, there were a couple of women, I believe. Maybe it was only one woman who came in between. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit. So maybe I'll turn this over to Craig and say, Craig, how do they get away with it? What is the mechanism? What stands between the wise people like you and Randy and me and Ray McGovern and engineering a proper outcome to this that looks back to Runnymede in 15, whenever it was, and the Magna Carta and the beginnings of what we called jurisprudence and that we believed in up until, me anyway, in my case, up until fairly recently. I'll shut up now.
Well, it's quite a large question. And it is a question of the ruling class or the establishment and how they operate informally. There was no committee or secret group of Freemasons or Illuminati or whatever that sit around and send out orders. It's just done through social structures. And, for example, Judge Swift, who issued that completely dismissive refutation of Julian's appeal, where, as you say, in just three double-spaced pages, he refuted 120 pages of legal arguments by some of the most distinguished lawyers in the world, and just said, well, there's nothing to answer. It's all nonsense. He was previously a lawyer for the government, and he's on record as stating that his favorite clients were the intelligence services. And he's always been an extremely right-wing, pro-government person. And he's the judge who in the High Court ruled that it was legal for the UK to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, for example. He's basically a right-wing nut job. And that ruling's thankfully be overturned. But to give an idea of how it works, the minister in the Foreign Office who was in charge of the policing and the cooperation with the Americans over the attempt to assassinate Julian while in the Ecuadorian embassy, for example, or at least to look at means of assassinating him, was a guy called Alan Duncan, a guy who called Julian a worm in the Houses of Parliament. And Alan Duncan's best friend at university was a guy called Burnett. And Burnett is now the Lord Chief Justice. And he's still Alan Duncan's best friend, and we know that because Alan Duncan says so in his diaries, which is published, that Burnett is his best friend. And they meet frequently for lunch. And Burnett is the Lord Chief Justice of England, and he's the person who dismissed Julian's appeal, which is the ruling that they were appealing to Swift against. It's networks of people like that. And of course, almost the entire media in the UK is either state-controlled, like the BBC, or all of the media that counts is owned by five billionaire-owned corporate groups. It's really a very small group of people who know each other and meet each other socially and who decide stuff and say things to each other in the club or over lunch. So people know which way they're supposed to rule in court. But it's all done socially. And the corruption is disguised. It's all terribly civilized. It's all just a word in the club. Oh, that guy Assange, he's awful, isn't he? Terrible old boy. That's all you have to say. And then the judge knows what he's meant to do. And that's the way it operates. And the public don't get to know of it, of course, because these people also, or their social group, also control the media. So... And of course, you have to put all this together with a situation where the concentration of wealth is getting worse and worse, and people have less and less control over their lives against the interests of the big corporations. So what's happening to Julian is awful, but it's one facet of the increasing concentration of power in society and its ability to crush dissent and freedom.
Interesting.
Interesting.
But that's interesting because you put your finger right on it. and what we would all go to, and everybody will say, well, how very infantile is it to suggest that it's an old Etonian club at its roots, at its heart, and that they actually, you know, they wear the same tie, and we all know what the old Etonian tie looks like. And although that's a symbol, really, of the club, and you can get into it even if you're a grammar school boy, but only if you play ball in exactly the correct way, and that the control that they have on the reins of power is still significant in this country. And it may be that those of us who look beyond the Enlightenment and what we thought was possibly the end of the Dark Ages in the 16th century or whenever are considered like dullards, really, but dangerous dullards, because we may foment sedition within the ranks of the people, and that we might at some point manage to effect some kind of change, and that actually Julian Assange's incarceration and their attempts to kill him are an indication of how seriously they take the whole idea that we the people might have information or might be allowed information that might make us less subservient to their general purposes, which is to continue to rule and to steal even more and more of the land or the money or whatever it is that is collected by the rich and powerful. And they do spend a fair bit of it on the press. You're quite right. And that's why the press, almost to a man, certainly in the United Kingdom and in the United States of America, where I live, will not stand up and complain. Except there was one feeble moment about 3 months ago, I think, where Le Monde and Figaro and the New York Times and I can't remember who else, probably the Grouniad or the Guardian, as it's sometimes known, sort of stood up and said, we really think you're being a little bit hard on Julian. You know, we did, after all, print all the information that he provided. But maybe they're just covering their arses, terrified that our rulers might turn round and kill all of them as well. I don't think they will, because they're all right, you know. It was a slip of the pen in their case, but this was the ringleader. Right. This was the guy with the idea that we, the people, actually should know what's going on, and we have an absolute right to know what's going on, or we would have an absolute right if any of us lived in what we could call a democracy, or if we had our freedoms, we, the people.
Right. And I want, gentlemen, I'd like to, it's so well said, I got to get out a dictionary to understand some of these words. You guys are so articulate. I want to play, as is Julian Assange, and this is exactly 7 years ago during the campaign for presidency in the U.S. in 2016. My first interview, I'm just a little pastiche, a little 2 minutes of him, how clear he analyzes that race. Reggie?
Hillary Clinton, who's kind of a predictable, boring, liberal war hawk, although I think probably now you have to question whether she's a liberal war hawk, because she's brought all the neocons onto her side as well.
She's close to Henry Kissinger, you know.
Well, it's much worse than that. She's like Robert Kagan, and who's the wife of Victoria Nuland, who was one of the best buddies at the State Department, who's behind a lot of the problems with Ukraine, has piled up with her, has made fundraising dinners for her. William Crystal.
Right.
Has also
endorsed
called
her.
Everyone to vote for, endorsed her, vote for Hillary. There's about 30 now. Basically, nearly all the neocons that were behind the Iraq War have now backed Hillary.
So
that tells you something very interesting. It tells you something about Hillary Clinton, but it also tells you something about Donald Trump, and it tells you something about the neocons. So the neocons' sense of identity and their interests are not strongly co-aligned with the Republican Party.
Right.
So they don't view, because I've believed naively that the neocons were deeply Republican, and why, you know, then if their interests differed to the candidate Donald Trump, for whatever reasons, they might not aggressively push him. That's very different to crossing the floor, and if you like, backing the enemy as far as the Republicans are concerned. So all along, the neocons were not really Republican; they were something else, and they had a different agenda.
All right. Go ahead, Craig. His analysis was spot on.
Absolutely. And we're now seeing, of course, the apotheosis of this in the Ukraine, where it's so-called liberals who are the people who are shilling for you know, been articles in The Guardian in the UK calling for NATO to declare war on Russia, which is going to result in nuclear oblivion for everyone. The absolute crazed war fever is coming from people who describe themselves as liberals and who want to see, in effect, total war, who want to see a war fought until it leads, that never quite open. They want to see the total destruction of the Russian economy. They want to see regime change in Russia. And they believe that the war in Ukraine can be fought for years and years with what would be hundreds and thousands, probably millions of dead before you reach that stage. And this has become mainstream. Now, that has become mainstream in opinion. And in fact, to question the idea that this war needs to be fought to total and utter victory and unconditional surrender and those kind of things, to question that idea makes you a bad person. You know, it's quite extraordinary that the thirst for bloodshed and the indifference to the terrible suffering and the killing of people on both sides, which is going on. Of course, it's the same kind of war fever which we saw in Libya, in Syria, and in Afghanistan, in Iraq. This thirst for destruction and for essentially imperial domination. But it's gone even crazier because now it's being directed at a more powerful adversary, and an adversary, you know, who's nuclear armed. So I just find it absolutely extraordinary. And it's taken over. The Democratic Party in the United States used to have a very powerful peace lobby and peace wing. And that has almost been obliterated. Even those people who were supposed to be on the left of the Democratic Party are out-and-out war hawks, wanting more and more war against Russia. I find it, you know, obviously extremely dangerous, extremely irresponsible, and terribly sad, because people are dying as we speak. As we speak, people are dying, people are being maimed, people are engaged in horrible warfare.
All right, before I go to you, Roger, I just want to play one more, and you take it from there, Roger. This is exactly what you're talking about. This is what Julian had said back in 2010, I believe. This is something I saw on television here.
The engine driving the lynching of Julian is not here.
On? All right, that's the wrong one. It's the other one. That's Chris Hedges. No,
it was listed.
All right. All right, forget about it. All right, so, Roger, why don't you pick up on that, and we'll on what...
Well, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
You can hear me. Okay. The Ukraine. Craig, Ukraine, my friend, eh? I'm going to read you a letter I wrote yesterday, because it has something to do with this. There's this bloke, all right. He's called Neil riches. And it turns out that he's no better than he should be. People are coming up with stuff about him, and he's a bookie, really. But he and friends or somebody started something called Play for Ukraine. And there's going to be a football match at Chelsea Football Club in a few weeks' time, with a lot of people, some of whom are very well-known footballers, all dressed in blue and yellow, and they're going to have a game of football, and they're getting probably fifty or 60,000 people to buy tickets and go. So, and he wrote to me and he said, could I use another Brick in the Wall Part 2, with the words changed a little bit, to promote it? So that's the only reason I looked into it. And this is what I wrote to him. I said, dear Neil, your initial request to me for permission to use my song, Another Brick in the Wall, I'd already written to him and said no at a certain point, but I needed to explain it a bit. Another Brick in the Wall Part 2 included a, quote, United 24 video of President Zelensky appealing for donations to the Ukrainian war effort, to add to the $200 million he claims he's already raised by United 24 for, among other things, quote, defence and demining and contributions towards the victory. In fact, in face of the inclusion of that video in your pitch to me, your contention that the Play for Ukraine initiative is only to assist in, quote, the rebuilding of schools that have been destroyed, end quote, and to quote you, quote, not in any other way whatsoever, appears disingenuous. Neil, there is still a chance for peace in Ukraine before it is completely destroyed. If peace can be achieved through a ceasefire and then negotiations, hopefully an opportunity will come to rebuild that devastated country, including the schools. I personally greatly admire Andriy Shevchenko as a footballer and Alexander Zinchenko and all the other great footballers you have assembled. I take my hat off to them all. Their hearts are obviously in the right place, but in my opinion, all the tub-thumping and flag-waving only encourages the prolongation of the callous and disastrous proxy war between the United States and the Russian Federation being waged at the expense of all the brave people of the Ukraine. A war that was not, as has so often been asserted, unprovoked. The only possible victory for the brave people of Ukraine is an end to the fighting. All informed opinion agrees Zelensky's idea of a victory is a pipe dream. The fighting could have been over in April 2022, almost before it began. We, the people of England, have a particular responsibility to encourage the leaders in the West and in the East to come to the table, because it was our then Prime Minister Boris Johnson who flew to Kiev on the 9th of April 2022, probably at the behest of Washington, and is believed by many to have scuppered an almost complete peace deal based on the Minsk Accords. That act led to these 16 months of death and destruction that has benefited no one except the armaments industries on both sides and possibly the hegemonic aims of a disastrous neocon administration in Washington, D.C. Don't get me started. Suffice it to say, my heart bleeds for all the people of Ukraine. Yeah, I'm a bleeding heart. P.S. All alone or in twos, the ones who really love you walk up and down outside the wall. Some hand in hand, some gathered together in bands. The bleeding hearts and the artists make their stand. And when they've given you their all, some stagger and fall. After all, it's not easy banging your heart against some mad bugger's wall. Love, R. P.S. If I had email addresses for Shevers and Zinchenko, I would copy them with this. So I sent that to what's his face, but he may well be in prison by now. I shouldn't have said that. They'll come and sue me. But my point is that the Bleeding Hearts, at least as far as the ruling class are concerned, are a dangerous breed and hopefully a dying breed.
Right.
And probably the most important Bleeding Heart in any of our lives will prove to have been Julian Assange, who put the empathy that makes your heart bleed into all his efforts to provide a system of getting information to we the people so that we might make informed decisions about matters of public policy. And that is the tragedy that we're witnessing. And that was central to my question for Craig earlier of how do they get away with it and what can we do?
All right. Listen, we have John Shipton on the line right now, and it's very early in Australia, and he was there the other day when Tony Blinken made those uncouth remarks, slighted, affronted the Australian people. John, are you there?
Yes, yeah. Hi. Hi. Hello, everybody.
Hey, John.
Hello, John.
All right, John. So everybody wants to know, what is the feeling there? I mean, the tea leaves, are they burning?
Well, you know, Australia has the power and the means to bring this to an end. And we have about 88% of the population supporting returning Julian home. To comment on Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State of the United States, comment while he was here, which was displayed no comity at all, but a certain irritation that the Australian people have decided they want the son of their soil returned home. He is a man who, for the last year and a half, has been involved in the administration of a war in Iraq, which has brought about the deaths of 350,000 young men, which you could characterize as a Y chromosome genocide. This person, with all the charm of Max Headroom, uttered the Julian endangered lives. It's beyond grotesque to get a handle on these things. How can one allocate a sensible array of feelings which describe a person who administers, helps administer, involves in the diplomatic acceptance of a mass murder or Y chromosome genocide, saying that a person who published some information endangered lives? You know, the obscenity is striking and very difficult to put into words. As for the English judiciary, you know, I'm an Australian and my mum and her family are all Irish people, and we have instinctively a jaundiced view of the English judiciary and the pretense that they hold up to be sons of the Declaration of at Runnymede, you know, that we are a shield of law between the people and the state. Australia is populated by convicts who judges in the English judiciary sent to Australia as convicts, in other words, slaves, by administering laws that selected people so that they could populate this country in its beginnings with slaves and the people who administer slaves, that, you know, convicts are no different. Look, the last count that I have in my head is, as Julian has been before, I think 25 the English judges, and only two of them in 2011 made decisions which you might say historically followed the administration of law. That's in the Supreme Court hearing where two of the judges said that the extradition should be refused. Lord Phillips, the deciding judge of the three, turned the administration of law to this, that he, and Craig can fill it out better than I, you know, I don't have much interest in English law, but that the Parliament had decided on the treaty arrangements between the United States and the United Kingdom by reading the English version of the treaty. also, the English version of the European arrest warrant system. However, Lord Phillips took it upon himself to take the French version of the European arrest warrant system and say that the law descended from that, and so Julian couldn't be could be extradited. So, you know, and that's 2011. It's sort of like historical now. The epoch and era has gone. It's completely changed. We're in a new epoch, which is very difficult for men of my age to understand, as the zeitgeist, you know, that I am in. It was full of vigor and enthusiasm for rebuilding the world. And here we are with what we built. It was a horror show. You know. Anyway, I don't want to depress everybody.
What I'd like to do right now, you talked about what he revealed and the people he put in danger, which is a pack of lies. This is what something that Roger has been playing in his shows for the last 13 years. Every single show, I saw it six times, and this is the collateral murder. This is just a part of it.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse, we have individuals going to the scene, looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
Hey, we need to stop that. We need down there. We need to shoot. You see my little...
Roger. Frank, Crazy Horse 1, request permission to engage.
I'm picking up the wounded.
See, I'm trying to get permission to engage.
Come on, let us shoot.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1A.
Taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1A.
It's Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV or bongo truck picking up the bodies. Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, Roger. This is Bushmaster 7, Roger, engage.
1A, engage. Clear.
Come on. Oh, yeah, look at that, right through the windshield.
Craig, whose lives did Julian put in danger? The operators of that helicopter, the gunners on that gunship? I mean, seriously, when you hear something like that, it always astounds me, and it gets me crazy listening or watching that. Just listening is enough, Craig.
Yeah, and it's actually quite interesting listening to it just then, without having seen the visuals. Just listening to the voices is even more chilling, because you're not distracted and you realize how totally callous about the business of killing these people are. And of course, there were children inside that vehicle that we heard the bullets go through, and they said they've gone through the windscreen. There were children inside there. which is just awful. No, we've been fighting off this lie about putting lives at risk. We've been fighting it for years. And, of course, nobody has ever come up with any example of anybody who suffered as a result. There's never been a single claim that a particular individual was harmed as a result of the WikiLeaks revelations. And, of course, for the late, great Daniel Ellsberg, when he gave his evidence in court, and it was put to him that even if nobody had been killed as a result of these revelations, some people may have had to leave their homes and go into hiding and may have been displaced. And he said, well, you're talking about wars which the US started, which displaced 6 million people. You know, how among 6 million people, if one or two of them, of those 6 million, were displaced because of WikiLeaks, as opposed to being among the vast multitude that were displaced by invasions by the United States. You know, how can you define the cause and how can you identify them in that huge number? And that was a great memory of Dan, his absolute contempt he showed in the witness box for the prosecution on behalf of the United States who are cross-examining him.
Right. Roger, you've played that. Millions of people have seen it. What has been the response? I mean, because of you, that message has been sent around the world. And I know you will continue to play it when you're down in South America. I guess when you're in London on the 8th and 9th of 9th and 10th of October. What's the response generally? I know what it was here, but what about in Europe?
You know, who's to say? I mean, I've been sitting here listening to you, listening to John and Craig and you, and who's to say? You know, eventually, and this sounds slightly defeatist, and I don't feel defeatist. I'm gonna be here in the barricade swinging until my last breath. So I don't feel defeated, but I do feel that the rich people who own the newspapers and the television stations and the people in the governments all over Europe and the United States who write the propaganda are creating a general public who, even if they come to see this is not a drill, the current Roger Waters show, and see that the collateral murder video that I got hold of in 2010 and have been showing at every single show I've done ever since, that they look at that and they go, And even if you tell them, that a lot of them will go, yeah, that was a bit of war. I wonder where that was. Oh, well, who cares? There's war going on all the time. It's part of our lives, and there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that, unfortunately and sadly, feels like that may be the feeling. Well, yeah, that... Well, I don't know about... Who, what? It was a couple of Reuters cameramen and then those children in the van afterwards, you know, and the driver of the van who was actually killed. He was actually trying to pick up one of the Reuters cameramen who was lying behind a wall, just trying to get away with his life from being murdered by the powers that be, and as an Apache attack helicopter with these, as you say, extremely callous young men in it, desperate to use their 30mm machine guns on these unarmed people who happen to be in the street in front of them because they have a bloodlust which they need to assuage in some way. So what good does it do? I'm not sure, but it's a bit like going to Second Avenue and standing outside the British Embassy with you, Randy, and others, you know, and about 100 of us there. Well, maybe, I don't know, 50,000 people walk by looking in shop windows at basketball boots and iPhones and wondering if they're going to spend the few dollars that they've got left on what? On that or some food? But But we're like a blip. We feel, standing in Second Avenue, we feel like a sort of irrelevant little blip. So the question that always comes to me is, and this is what we're trying to do, that's why we're doing this program and we're talking to one another, is how do we turn that blip into, instead of being those 50 people that you and I spoke to in Washington, D.C., Randy, that day, we turn them into like 2 million people at the monument, at the Lincoln Memorial, or in that big park there, absolutely demanding of the current administration, Blinken, Biden, Sullivan, Newland, but all of them. No, you have to have a moment of sanity, and which for most of you, all those I've named, would be one moment of sanity in an entire life and career of absolute madness. They're all completely crazy, but we put up with them. It comes back to the question I was asking at the beginning. Why do we, how is it that we get to put up with Priti Patel and Boris Johnson and Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken and all the rest of them that are all part of this weird charade that operates for what? To make sure that the law in the United States, the only law that seems to matter them, which is to maximize profits for shareholders in companies, is upheld. And if they uphold that law, no other law, and nothing else matters, so long as that is supported. And somehow, through the media and their propaganda, they've managed to persuade us, the great unwashed, that that is the only thing that matters, when we know in our bleeding hearts that it's not. But I feel in these situations, talking amongst friends, I confess I feel somewhat ineffectual. Yeah. But that won't stop me going on.
Right.
But this is the first battle. That's why Julian is so important.
Right.
This is the most important battle. The fact that we failed to get nuclear weapons banned, you know, back in the early 60s by marching from Aldermaston to London and listening to Bertrand Russell and Canon Collins in Trafalgar Square, and then the women at Greenpeace, and blah, year after year after year of speaking perfect sense, has had no effect at all on public policy. But we don't stop. But it's interesting to contemplate whether or not in our lifetimes or beyond, or in the lifetime left to the human race, given the way we behave, that the voice of reason will ever be heard and will be taken notice of and listened to. Voice of reason.
Right. Craig, I'm going to go to you, and then we're going to bring in another former ambassador from Argentina to comment your response to what Roger just so poetically laid out.
Well, it's a great question. You know, why do you, well, firstly, how do you build it into a mass movement and how do you affect change? And I think the answer to that is that it's extremely difficult, and it probably depends on building on wider discontent about other things. You know, that as people get less and less empowered in their lives, less and less security of employment, less and less certainty of decent housing, less and less certainty that their children will have a good quality of life, at that stage they get open to the idea that there's something wrong with society more fundamentally, and they might start listening to you. But it's extremely difficult. And of course, what made the establishment so scared of Julian was his amazing use of the internet to get information to people, which could build radicalism, and which did so much to build popular resistance to the war in Iraq. Since those days, in all the years of Julian's various incarcerations in the embassy and in Belmarsh, we've seen the internet become much less We've seen an awful lot of suppression. We've seen Twitter and Facebook arise as the great gatekeepers who most traffic goes to, who are, of course, corporate and have strong links to the security services. So it's got harder and harder. But there's also, you know, there's a duty, I think we all feel here, a duty to resist. That even if the resistance is hopeless, even if we actually believe we could never win, and I don't believe, you know, that there will never be social progress again. I don't believe that. But even if I did believe that, I would still resist. It's almost an existentialist thing that standing for the truth is part of my being. It's part of who I am. It's part of why I'm here. And that I have no choice but to go on resisting and to go on declaring the truth. Right. And that's something which I'm pretty sure all of us would share.
Thank you, Craig. Fighting for Julian, and she has done this for a long time. She's a very close friend. She's the former ambassador from Argentina to the UK, and she spent a lot of time with Julian. Alicia Castro joins us from Buenos Aires. Welcome to the show. It's been a long time, Alicia.
Hello, Ronnie. How are you? I have my English is as rusty as my throat is with a cold, so I hope that you can you let can I speak Spanish for your large Latino audience? It'd be nice.
We'll do another show tomorrow on Latino focus.
Right. Bueno, buenas tardes, en todo caso.
No,
no. I love to you all. I was listening to you carefully, and I met John in the Ecuadorian embassy with Barbara. I don't know, John, if you remember me.
Yes, I do. Yes.
And I'm still almost every week crying for the situation of Julian. I think it's we used to say that the decision to extradite Assange would worry anyone who cares about journalism or free speech or about democracy. But it's also about truth, and it's also about power. So he is a big challenge. He knows it, and he accepts his... I know, I always had the feeling that he knew that it was going, he was going to be extradited, and he took the risk. And it was difficult to stop him for doing what he had to do. And we can discuss forever if this is aligned with judicial systems here or there. Of course, it's not aligned with justice at all, and it doesn't correspond to the extradition treaty between UK and United States, because it's not for, you cannot extradite for political reasons. Of course, this is a political case. It's obvious. And it's also obvious that the recent remarks of Blinken's are terrible from a diplomatic perspective, because they show that they have no reading of Australia, where the 89% of the population wants Julian released, etc. But we are in a crisis civilizatoria, in a crisis of civilization, total and complete. And they don't mind. They just don't mind. So I think that people try, I think young, not everybody knows what it is about. I feel that in South America, for instance, that's why I'm always trying to do tweets in Spanish or that sort of things, because I was listening carefully to what you were saying about the collateral murder video, and people, yes, they think it's a peace, it's war, and there's war everywhere, so we should always link the image of Julian to that piece of work, no? because when I met Julian, I met Julian in 2012, the year I arrived in London as ambassador, and he was detained. He had the diplomatic asylum of Ecuador, of Correa, and just settled in the embassy of Hans Crescent Street, blocks from our house in Belgrave Square. And that day, the embassy was surrounded by cars of the British police, and some agents struggled to enter. Do you remember Anne Alban, John, I'm sure?
Yes.
She was a very courageous woman, and I called her and we said, what can I do? And my first reaction was to send food, so I sent empanadas y alfajores to alleviate the doings of the ambassador. And during the following days, we organized a meeting of Latin American ambassadors to follow from the delegation of Ecuador, the session of the Organization of American States, where the asylum of Assange was discussed. And in that way, we would get the ambassadors there to give support. Not all of them went quickly. They were saying, well, I have to ask home, or they send the second one. And we sat for the first time around that dark table in the room, and suddenly and discreetly, as we all were waiting, Julian Assange burst in, and he was legend. He has that aura of being a hero, and what I expressed was how much we as Latin Americans had to thank him for his revelations about the diplomatic cables that showed the degree of interference of the United States governments in our affairs. And that day began a long series of encounters that I had with Julian throughout the 4 years of my tenure in London and subsequent years when I went to visit him until 2017. And our first conversation was around the accusation of Sweden of Sweden women about sexual abuse, because that would take the support of the feminists, and I'm also work with unions and feminists in the unions were telling me, well, yes, but it's this accusation. So I wanted to make clear. And very, very soon I concluded that it was a fabrication of two unscrupulous women with whom he had had casual relationships and had been manipulated to accuse him of criminal doings. And Sweden demanded his extradition to respond to these allegations. They never pressed charge against him while his lawyers and us were waiting that he could testify in London, since Sweden would extradite him to the United States. And at that time, and I want to share these recuerdos with you, because it's a very rich. It was a very rich time. The embassy was crowded with interesting people who visited him, who wanted to see him: philosophers, politicians, musicians, designers. And if I regret that one day I missed Zizek or Yoko or whoever, the next meeting I was seeing Vivian or Helena Kennedy or Ken Loach or Gavin McFadyen, and many of them are still my friends today. And we tried to alleviate his confinement with any excuse. We celebrated his birthdays. We even celebrated the 100 days of asylum, and we thought it was going to be quick. So we thought we have to take this opportunity to make a cake with the number 100, or spend Christmas or the end of year with him while Well, at the same time, President Correa was recognized, and Ecuador was recognized by progressive sectors as a defender of human rights. And what I tell everybody is that in each of my long conversations with Julian, I learned that he was a man with a mission, that he was a man obsessed with an uncommon mission to democratize truth. Unlike other platforms, WikiLeaks does not reveal, as we know, information related to certain political affiliation, but publishes the information that he received. And he published more than 10 million classified documents revealing the secrets that once belonged to a small elite linked to the military-industrial complex. Sometime I would ask him, do you know something else of from Argentina or from Venezuela? I was former ambassador to Venezuela, and I know that Venezuela is one of the strategic points that the United States want to invade. And he always said the same thing. If I would have something, I would have published it. And those were the times. And the last time I saw him in 2017, his situation was worrisome. The president of Ecuador changed to the horrible Lenin that would give him to British police, hand him to the British police. And he knew that he was being spied on. We all knew that we were spied. He had a ribbon hanging from his neck with a series of pen drives. We talked in the dining room around the table, raising the volume of the radio. Well, you all know that.
And writing
what we would like to tell to the other in a book, and exchanging two notebooks and covering our heads to avoid cameras and microphones. And I knew that he would never give up. And he would never give up wherever he stays, wherever he's sent to. He would never give up. And we neither.
Right. Listen, we have to take a quick 30-second station break. I got to do a station ID. We'll be right back with everybody here. And then Ray McGovern's going to be joining us. Okay, that's Dmitri Shostakovich, a suite for a variety of strings. I'm Randy Credico. Randy Credico live on the fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI, WBAI.org, Free Speech Radio. Now, before I go to Ray, Roger, you're going to be playing in Argentina in November. How is that shaping up?
Well, we're sold out in River Plate in Buenos Aires, a couple of shows. I'm running into quite a lot of flack from the Israeli lobby, telling the promoter there that he has to cancel me because I'm an anti-Semite. My friends in Argentina have already voted with their feet and their credit cards, and I cannot wait to get back to Argentina and to be with that wonderful audience. Right. I mean, the same is true all over South America.
Montevideo as well, right?
Absolutely. Going to Uruguay and Brazil, obviously. I think I'm playing in Rio and Sao Paulo. And speaking of Ecuador, I'm playing in Quito for the first time this time. So I've been there before, obviously, visiting Lagagrio with Steve Donziger and stuff. So I'm much, much looking forward to it. Who knows? It could possibly be the last shows that I do. I will be 80 in September, so I don't know how
You're
much longer
I can go. You're not looking a day over 50. 80 is the new 50.
But I'm so much glad that I'm going back to South America. Elisa, we've never met, but welcome.
I got tickets for November, so please don't cancel.
All right. All right. I'm going there, too. And I know a lot of the Madres de Plaza de Mayo are going to be there, and human rights activists are going to be there. You are well-loved. It was the first
There's
day.
I ain't canceling anything. I have that in common with our friend Julian Assange. None of us around this table give up, ever. You know, I was thinking, listening to Elisa telling us that story about... I've never met Julian, so I hang on every word of those of you who have. But I get the sense, you know, it's like being in the room when Elisa describes it so beautifully in her impeccable English, I have to say. Give up? No, that ain't going to happen. I just pulled up an MP4, which later on I'm happy. I want to get to Ray as quickly as possible.
All right, let's get to...
Hang on, let me finish. Yes. I hadn't finished. But it's a part of my show in Manchester, the last show that I did in England, and it's the little bit of the speech that I made about how we can rouse ourselves to make more noise. And that is the important thing, at least from my perspective. We have to figure out not just how to make the choir bigger, but how to make it louder. And so that's where my mind is going, because I'm a bit of a showman. Anyway, let's get to Ray.
Can you play that? Is there any way we can
do
that?
Yeah, I can, but not now.
All right.
I want to get
Ray McGovern's been waiting, biting at the bit for about an hour now, I believe. Not that long, because he didn't get his link. He's been waiting for a while. Ray, but you're a patient man, you're a wise man, and welcome to the show again. You have set the record, you and Craig Murray, both about 90 times. You there, Ray?
Somewhere.
I can hear him.
I can't hear Ray. Wait a second.
While Ray is coming, may I take the opportunity to tell Roger that the governor of Tierra del Fuego is inviting him to go. Tierra del Fuego is the southernmost province, and he's supposed to rule the Malvinas Islands that, as you well know, they are occupied.
Yeah.
We have it's the last colonial enclave, and we have a large British NATO base there with around 2,000 soldiers, and Ushuaia is only 500 kilometers from there, and he would love to have you there, Roger.
Well, I would love to visit Tierra del Fuego.
Also.
Strangely enough, a very close friend of my grandfather's was a man called E. Lucas Bridges, who wrote a really interesting book about Tierra del Fuego called The Uttermost Part of the Earth, because he lived there for a long time with the Ona Indians. And so I feel I have some kind of familial connection. Mm. So I've been to Patagonia before, but never to the deep tip, you know. So I'd love to go.
Listen, Ray is reconnecting, but we haven't heard from Craig Murray in a while. Craig, are you still there?
I am still here, but I thought even less have we heard from John Shipton. I don't know if John's
I haven't heard
us,
John. Well, listen, I want to hear from both of you. John, just as a father, this must be very painful. When was the last time you saw Julian? And needless to say, you're a little rattled by this entire ordeal.
No, I'm okay, thank you. And, you know, I'm engaged in the fight. I saw Julian in October, you know, it's always good to see him, and always he never, ever complains, and neither does Gabrielle. I find that very heartening and a fundamental strength of being, you know, that doesn't indulge in self-pity. But with all the other matters that have been traversed this evening or this morning, you know, I find myself much more intellectually and emotionally violent in my condemnation of the United States embarking upon this last 22 years of warfare and producing in its elites people, one after the other, who are nothing but vultures. Or I would say, you know, the Brown University, 38 million refugees, Brown University, 4.6 million dead in the last 20 years. Gideon Pollier, an excess death researcher in Australia, estimates 6 to 7 million excess deaths in the 20 years. There must be over the Middle East a pall of grief, thundercloud thick, and like a thundercloud, full of lightning and anger. And we can see the transition, you know, that Africa is abandoning in the colonial efforts of the last. I remember Jules Nereri, how we look forward to the blooming of Africa, and then it descended into client states one after the other. And I see now that they're taking off those shackles. With the Assange matter, you know, the 88% of Australians supporting or insisting Julian be returned is not magic. It didn't come about as magic. It came about from the work of Roger and Craig and yourself and Ray McGovern and myself and Gabrielle. So, and it spreads out. 60 event tour of the United States. I don't know how. Honestly, I think to myself about Roger all the time. How does he do it? We just did 60 events on 42 cities across the United States, and I'm nearly dead. And Roger's going on, you know, for a year at a time touring. So the, you know, determination that exists within this group and within the group of friends that surround us to get Julian out of the circumstances and home to his kids, it will be successful. Australia has the means, the methods, and the capacity to insist to the United States that it's to be done. Also, within the United States, there is, you know, having done 60 events in 47 or 48 days, and that was our sixth visit, there is the essence to build upon to change the circumstances. And the political and social circumstances in the United States are so fractious now that the possibility of altering the intentions of the Department of Justice has now become really evident. We can do it. There is talk of a deal at the moment. Actually, in 2021, January, we're in New York, and Ben Wisner suggested that, there, you know, he had heard that a deal was possible, and that now in Australia they're running around the place saying, you know, a deal is possible. That to us here, to me, you know, makes me a bit cross, because they place the burden of upon the victim, they place the burden of decision upon Julian. You know, you accept a plea deal. So we've progressively broken down the resistance, and now we're at a plea deal. We continue until that's removed and Julian's returned home.
Yeah, all hands on deck, and we all have to get out there and do something. Everybody here is doing something, including Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern, we lost you for a moment, but you've been listening to a good part of this show. Your thoughts on what you've heard the last hour?
Hi, Ray.
Well, I've been well-educated. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
You can. Great. Well, first to Roger.
Yeah.
Go play for us, Argentina. This is going to be great.
No, Andrew Weber here, please. All right, go ahead.
Well, no.
Lord Weber to you.
Lord Alan Duncan to you.
Yeah. It's not easy to say, Lord Lloyd Webber.
Yeah. Andrew Dice Webber.
Hey, it's my turn, you guys. My
All
turn.
Right, you got 30 seconds left, Ray.
Get on with it, Ray.
To John Shipton. John, I just knew you were Irish. I just knew that Julian was Irish. You know, we Irish have a hard time really realizing that anger is a virtue. My source for that is none Socrates. Other than Thomas Aquinas, okay? What he said was that virtue is the anger. That's the mean between cowardice and always being ticked off. And the opposite of the virtue of anger is unreasoned patience. And what Aquinas said about that is unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and prompts not only bad people, but good people to do evil. Okay? So let's be virtuous, all of us, we Irish included, and have the kind of righteous anger that is indeed, I believe, virtuous. I don't have to tell you all that. I'm just reflecting on my own Irish roots and what my grandfather told me, they all came from Ireland. They missed out going to Australia by just a decade or so.
Who's
they
making that noise?
In New York, and the first thing my Somebody's grandfather made. Told me, now, Raymond, now, do you know why the sun never sets on the British Empire? And I said, no, I don't. He said, well, it's because the good Lord would never trust the British in the dark.
So, come on, man. Come on. That's funny-ish.
Yes. Funny-ish.
So who would have known that British jurisprudence had a, what's it called? Like an expiration date on it. Looks like it was 800 years since the Magna Carta, and the British were our vassals in implicating what is now called, get this, the rules-based international order. And who makes the rules? Well, we make the rules. And that beginning, talking about the British clubs and all, reminded me of an expression we used in the Bronx, a plague on your stuffy old clubs. The problem is that Biden tries to be a member of those clubs. Now, Biden was mentioned for a second. I think he plays a role here as a kind of a puppet for the Hillary Clinton wing of what used to be a Democratic Party. I want to cite something here because it escaped any attention in our press. It was Biden exactly 1 week ago. He was in Maine, and he made several rhetorical flourishes in public. And then when people ask, well, what does he really think in private? Well, he came out because he came to a very small, well, what was it, a private home in Maine, and he gave his personal visions. And what did he say? Well, he referred to Madeleine Albright's reference to the U.S. as the essential nation. Actually, she said indispensable nation, didn't she? That means, by definition, all other nations are what?
Dispensable.
Dispensable, I guess, yeah, okay. Exceptional, indispensable. And he applauded, and he said, this is what we mean by leadership of the United States in world affairs. Now, get this quote. Here's Biden, quote, Who could possibly bring the world together? Not me, but the President of the United States. Who could do it unless the President of the United States does it? Who? What nation could do it? Oh, God. So, the commentator here is a professor, a Democratic Party partisan, and she says, you know, Biden's vision, it reaches back to the 1940s, to the post-war institutions that helped to rebuild Europe and create lasting alliances. Whoa. She's behind the times as well, right? Then she finally says that this is what Biden finished up with saying. If the whole world is changing, Biden said, we just need to grab hold. There is nothing beyond our capacity, end quote. From the professor, recording this, one sentence. If I were writing a history of the Biden administration 150 years from now, I would call out this informal talk as an articulation of a vision of American leadership, end quote. Give me a break. Biden and his administration are in for a comeuppance, not only in Ukraine, where they will suffer utter defeat within 2 months, my prediction, but also because the Hunter Biden and Joe Biden corruption that is now documented in lots of court documents, his campaign is doomed. And what is he going to do? What is Biden going to do? That's the question.
What do you think, Ray? Can I ask you a question? Why is he running? Why is Biden running?
Well, because Hillary told him to run, and the establishment has nobody else. And
it's a weak, a very weak bench. The Democratic Party.
Yeah, they have no bench at all. So there is some hope for, I hate to mention his name, Bobby of the Lobby. If Bobby can shake off the lobby, I will have no compunction for explaining what he stands for, which is what I stand for. I really have problems with his inordinate devotion to the indispensable nation of Israel. But the problem is the campaign is doomed. What's going to happen? He'll probably be impeached, in my view. Who's going to come forward? I don't know, but things are in flux, okay? And when things are in flux, I think that things might break open for our friend Julian. And I dearly hope and pray that they do. It's not impossible. We have to keep striving for supporting him, as we all do. You know, when Alicia talked about meeting him in the embassy for the first time, I had a similar experience. It was wonderful. We had Sam Adams Associates there. We had just given Julian our award, our annual award for integrity. And he came through the door after we were having some wine. And I was near the door, and I said, this is good. So I went up to him, and I said, Julian, I'm Ray McGovern. And he looked at me, and he said, well, I know. So I said, you've been reading my stuff? He says, no. I see you on YouTube. Now, what's the lesson there? The lesson is don't spend so damn much time a governor writing beautiful prose. Get on YouTube. Get on public media, social media. That's what's done it for Bobby Kennedy so far. And Julian was saying, he was just 40 years old at the time. He's saying, look, I'm with this younger generation, McGovern. I don't give a rat's ass what you write. I see you on YouTube, and that's what you should direct your efforts to. I'm just belatedly getting to that now. I even have an appearance every Monday on George Napolitano's show. But just the notion that, Julian was the young, hopeful breakthrough here, that the social media are still there, and there are lots of disciples of Julian. We just have to carry it forth, and we have to never give up. Thanks for letting me say my piece.
All right, you got it there. Now, I got to go to Craig. Craig, this was originally a show with just me and Craig, but he said, we got to broaden it, Credico, because you can't carry it for a whole hour. But it's 2 hours. He didn't say that. But Craig, pick up where Ray left off there.
It's quite tough to follow, Ray. Hi, Ray. Really good to hear you from you again. Actually, we haven't spoken for a while. I hope I'll see you when I come over to the States shortly.
I sure hope so, Craig. Thanks.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, the perception that Julian stood for, you know, a great period of hope, and the use of new media and social media to deepen democratic empowerment and try to make a meaning of our failing democracy, in which people have got very little chance to actually affect policy through the rather stale political parties. I think that there was that very, very real feel of hope and freedom back 15 years ago. Sadly, it's very hard to maintain that feeling of hope now, but all the people who felt that hope, or the large majority of them, still exist and are still there and are still ready to be reinvigorated. And having Julian's leadership back again would, of course, be a tremendous thing, which is one reason why the state and the establishment were so keen to stop Julian's leadership becoming available again. But I agree absolutely with Ray, that this is a time of tremendous flux in United States politics. And that kind of flux and shake-up of the status quo and danger to the status quo is a moment of great opportunity, opportunity for change, and opportunity that something may break in Julian's case. And who would have thought, I mean, looking at it, taking a step back and considering that the most likely challenger to be president of the United States in the forthcoming presidential election, that the government of the United States is trying to deal with that by putting that person in prison so in order to prevent their election. You know, that's really quite extraordinary. We have a situation today in Russia where Navalny has been sentenced to another 19 years in jail. And I should say, I mean, I'm very much opposed to the war on Ukraine. I want to see a negotiated settlement. I want to see both sides step back from war and killing and negotiate a settlement. But I'm not in favor of Putin or his regime. And I think the sentence today for Navalny is not justifiable. But the United States is trying to put its main political opponent in jail. And we see, of course, the same with hypocrisy with relation to the United States journalist who's in jail in Russia. I think I'll get his name wrong. I think it's Evan Gershovitz, I think.
That's it. Wall Street Journal.
And, you know, there's so much outrage in the mainstream media about the jailing of that young man. And personally, I think they're right to be outraged. I mean, if Russia didn't want him, they should have deported him. They shouldn't have been jailing him. But this is total hypocrisy when Julian Assange is imprisoned in really identical circumstances. So where, you know, the accusation is of publishing documents or publishing facts harmful to national security. So we live in this time, this extraordinary time of political flux, where things are happening which don't appear to make sense, which nobody could have predicted 10 or 20 years ago, which appear to fundamentally undermine the rule of law and fair justice, which appear to throw the First Amendment out the window in the United States. It's a very, very dangerous time, but it also is a time that brings some opportunity.
You know, Craig, I was in Russia when he was arrested, and then I went to the DPR, the Donetsk People's Republic, and there were no reporters from the west there. And there were HIMAR missiles hitting that the city, the capital of Donetsk People's Republic. And I was there and I saw it, and it was coming from Ukrainians. And this guy, what I couldn't figure out, why was I there, this comedian with a radio show, why was I there reporting on it? There was nobody else. And that guy from the Wall Street Journal, instead of going west, he goes east, and he's, you know, by these the military-industrial complex of Russia area, and he's getting blueprints. Why wasn't he where I was? Why did I have to go? Why was I the one that was reporting on what was going on in there? And I'm not a wartime correspondent, you know what I mean? But there was nobody else there. Eva Bartlett had been there, but nobody from the mainstream media, particularly the Wall Street Journal, they were not there. And people, I don't want to...
Well, Randy, come on. We all know there are only one. They only wanted to tell one side of that particular story, which is the USA empire and its democracy, and the Ukrainians are brave and freedom-loving and democratic, and they've got to destroy Russia before they go on and destroy China. It's just a non. It's not hard to understand, my friend. It really isn't hard. I'm really glad you went. I admire you for it. I looked at all your reports and blah, blah, blah. I tell you what, would you mind if I get back to something Ray said? Because
yes.
It's been burning a hole in my brain ever since he said it. And what he said was, YouTube, he said. And it went bing in my mind because, you know, I was going to play you that little clip from my show.
You can.
I might play it to you now because it's about the choir. Because what Ray was saying was, how do we become effective? How do we get our message that Julian Assange must be released because he's committed no crime across the... This is... I think this should come out just through these speakers.
All right.
I'm going to try it. If it doesn't...
All right. It's live on the fly. It doesn't matter.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight. I'm going to die in just a second. Just to stretch my legs.
Can you hear that?
Yep. Yes.
Yes.
I'm going to check out the echo. Oh, no. Hang on. Sorry. I've got to spool through this because I want you to hear what I had to say.
All right. Go ahead.
It's probably taking too long. Hang on. Try again.
All right.
We're going to do...
No, let me finish. The mic is mine.
I've seen it. Yes, it's yes, great.
It's great.
I don't care. Let me finish what I wanted to say. Yeah. So it's just me standing up and talking about Julian, and I was talking about the choir, and so I'm talking about the 80% of the people that John was talking about in Australia. And they manifest for me as a choir with a voice, of voices singing in harmony, and they're singing for the freedom of Julian Assange. And I talk about how there are 500 million of us about, as represented by the governments that are all trying to get Julian Assange released, and so on and so forth. And I said we need to at least double, hopefully quadruple that number in the next few months or whatever, so that the choir is louder. Because, and then I start shouting at the audience in Manchester and say, we need to be loud, and I scream loud, and they all start cheering and clapping, and I said, yeah, loud, come on, and they all scream loud, really loud. But it was a nice moment and blah, and it makes good TV, but Ray brought me back down to earth by saying the words YouTube. And he's absolutely right. The places that seem to be coming more important are, well, there's two words, Joe and Rogan. That is where you finally start to get some traction, is apparently independent, although he sold his whole caboodle for a sandwich and a beer and $100 million to Daniel Ek from Spotify. Nevertheless, he is free to say what he wants, and so are his guests. And it may be that Ray has hit the nail on the head, saying that it's the same mechanism that Julian figured out It has to happen through the internet. We cannot grow our choir by gathering 50 of us together in Second Avenue in front of the British Consulate. The next time we go, it hasn't turned into 10,000, and the next time 100,000. It doesn't work.
Right.
It just doesn't work. But what Ray says leads me to want to open the conversation again here, following Ray, is how do we make it work using the internet and using TikTok and Weihei and whatever all the other mechanisms are that we may or may not approve of. So I'll shut up again now. But we have to make the choir louder, and I think Ray's right. So can we talk about that?
Yes, we can talk about that. What I want to do is we got 15 minutes, 20 minutes left. So I'm giving all four of you 5 minutes. I know, Ray, you got cut short there in the beginning, but you fell out. And, you know, I'm sorry about that. But Ray and then Alicia and then Craig and then Roger, you'll close it because we are going to close out with us and them. All right. So I'll go to you first, Ray.
Well, I would just say that I think Roger is right on. I wish I had some clever suggestions. What I've been saying is that our inability to do precisely what Roger and I are suggesting may not be in our stars, but in ourselves. My grandchildren could help us. My children, of course. Young people can figure out how to do this stuff, okay? And the Joe Rogans and others, they're available to younger people. And I just want to say that where there's a will, there's a way. And with the people on this call, they are sure as hell there's a lot of will. So let's try to be a little bit more imaginative, maybe a little bit more humble. I know I don't have the answers, but let's seek the answers from people with the technological skills and the political motivation that exists. We just have to find it.
You know, listen, this is the only station in on the East Coast, along with the Pacifica outlet in D.C., and you got the Pacifica Network, where we could even have a discussion like this. You can't find it anywhere else but on the Pacifica Network. What happens if we go, Ray?
I don't know. There are lots of other ways. I have to admit that I rejoice being compelled to be up on the news over the weekend because Judge Napolitano, of all places, of all fellows, has me on first thing on Monday morning.
But they can censor him. They can censor him on YouTube.
Well, I guess they can, but. Anyway, there are ways around this. There are technical ways around it, and we've got to find them. I think we can. It just requires a lot more digging and maybe a little bit more humility on my part to figure out, well, don't write those fancy articles.
Ray, you've done it. I'm going to interrupt you again. You've done it, my brother. You've put your finger on it. Young people, people who understand the mechanism, people who get it, people who've grown up with it. People who understand the internet, you were talking. It has nothing to do with local radio, nothing to do with it at all. That's like, this is, we are small fry. You're quite right, Randy, and we could get censored. But the internet, just imagine if there were a million young people working on this in consort, all of whom have a laptop and all of whom have 50 friends, and they are all tapping in all the right messages to free Julian Assange all day long, every day. That is the choir. Ray is absolutely right.
I agree. I know it's a small station, but at least, the 50 people that might show up in front of the UK embassy or council here in New York, listen to this show, and I can get people there. If I don't have this, and then I get censored on the internet. I was thrown off of Twitter just for 2 weeks a month ago, and I don't even know why.
That's a different story. That is a huge story.
I mean, X,
story.
Not Zitter. Twitter.
Yeah. Zither?
Zither.
Yeah, the censorship of the internet, that is a huge parallel story.
Right.
That's a different story.
All right, let me
huge.
Go to Alicia here, and then we're going to go to Craig and Mr. Shipton, and then, Roger, you'll close it. So go ahead, Alicia, some last words.
Well, I think that we should keep thinking and doing and working. Many things had been done, I mean, and the Belmarsh Tribunal that we framed in the Progressive International, the Peace and Justice Movement is always on it. And let's ask Julian what to do next, through Stella maybe. My idea was always to talk to the Pope, because the truth is a very keen instinct to Catholics. Solo la verdad no será libre, es la verdad, en verdad, la verdad os digo. I mean, what is it more important than truth? And we don't want a martyr, we don't want a Christ, we want Julian with us. So we spoke to the Pope, and Stella spoke to the Pope, and I hope that was a force that could touch POTUS, but it's not happening. I mean, we talked to him, but it's not happening. The next step, I don't know if it's happening or not, but it's not. Nothing had been done yet. So let's ask Julian.
Right. He's Argentine, too, Pope Francis. All right, so I'm going to go to you, Craig, and then you, Mr. Shipton, and then Roger for some closing remarks here.
There are substantial numbers of young people around the campaign, which is good to see. It is sometimes quite difficult. I've been a few times into universities lately to talk about Julian. And we don't realize, as you know, all of us get a little older, you don't realize how quickly time is passing. You're talking to a university audience, and you know, the people are sitting there looking at you, who are 19, and they were babies, or some of them not born yet, when Iraq was invaded. You know, that's a further away event for them than the Second World War event was to our generation. And that happened, you know, a generation before we were born. We're talking about, when you were talking about the collateral murder video and things, as Roger said, you know, a lot of people look at it and think, well, yes, that was a war somewhere. Wars happen all the time. What was that? The difficulty is that the moment that we all remember of the great anti-war movement around the world and of the burst through of freedom on the internet, it was some time ago. And it doesn't mean that young people don't remember it. They've brought up in a much more controlled world where there's much less freedom on the internet, and maybe they don't all appreciate fully the potential of it. Having said that, I agree entirely. I've tried myself sometimes to do videos on YouTube, and they get, you know, a few tens of thousands of viewers as opposed to hundreds of thousands, and they tend to be me sitting there in a very static way in front of my books in my study, talking earnestly to the screen for an hour or so, and that appeals to a limited number of people who have a particularly intellectual bent, but it's not going to reach a mass audience. It's not snappily cut. It doesn't include sound bites that you can get out onto TikTok or Snapchat or whatever these things are called. It is indeed important we do that. But we should also go where the audience is. I mean, if this chap Rogan has such an enormous audience, we should get onto the Rogan show. We should be thrusting ourselves into areas of which have an audience, which are perhaps not so tightly controlled. And also, of course, you need content for your social media. So doing the physical events, like standing in Second Avenue. Yes, maybe it doesn't convert that many people there and then, but it does provide you content and visual material that you can use as part of your social media presentation that then goes out on the internet. So there's always a marriage of the two.
Right. John Shipton,
this is not
you're making this not a shiva but an Irish wake, so have at it.
Thanks. We spent the last 12 months in Australia setting up infrastructure in the United States and Australia to do similar things to Rogan and others. Feeding every event you feed in into the internet and all use live feeds and so on. What I find is that so the cycle, money, people and politics, we cut out and we just go people and then politics. So I go to Brazil week after next for a couple of weeks and off to France and so on. But doing the tours and then pulsing the tours out onto the net and having the infrastructure to have good talking heads or interviewers is a lot of money, and we've managed to raise the money, and it's now established. I think a couple of weeks' time. So you know, you have to have a charitable organization and a charitable organization in the United States, and which we've done. So it's quite complex and quite a lot of money. It's done. But in essence, what Roger does and what Craig does and what you do and Ray McGovern and Alicia, it combines together to be, and it only comes over the internet. It only comes, we're now on the internet. It's just having the a popular talking head and at the same time doing the tours, just go on the road, go to the people, and the people convert to politics and interest, regional interest, over and over and over again. It's exhausting, but other young people come after it. The essence of it is this, simply. I say it over and over again to every group, that the genius of a people ascends from the people, from the loins of the men and women that constitute a people. It doesn't come down from the White House. What comes down from the White House seems to me to be idiocy, but the genius of a people ascends from us and goes upward from us. I can see from all of the people here this evening that none have moved from a class of people which we'd call a ruling class, and yet that the people here this evening have displayed a range of genius which you can only say ascends from us. And youth understands that and loves to hear it.
All right. Well, well said, John. Before I go to you, Roger, I just want to say Craig Murray will be in the U.S. on September 2nd for a couple of weeks. There'll be a lot of events. Stay tuned to this station and on the internet where Craig will be speaking and maybe getting arrested in front of the U.K. embassy. No, you're not doing civil disobedience here. But Craig will be in this country on September 2nd for a couple of weeks, and we look forward to seeing you then, Craig. And so, Roger, before we go out with the us and them from a concert you did in 2018 in Amsterdam, your final thoughts. Got 5 minutes.
Well,
if Craig's coming over at the beginning of September, I hope he will agree to break bread with his humble servant before he gets arrested in front of the British Embassy on Second Avenue, because I would take that as a great honour and a big, great pleasure. Anyway, it's been fascinating to hear everybody talk about where we go from here, you know, which I know is something that, and it's really elevating and encouraging to listen to John talk about his forthcoming tour, the next bit, the going to France, the going to the Brazil, the keeping the torch moving around the world in the magnificent the way that he and Gabriel do and have done for all these years. The Pope, well, yeah, wouldn't that be lovely? But it's a bit, it comes back a bit to Ray's kind of hope and pray thing. As a radical atheist, I don't have much faith in the Pope, but I know I'm in a minority. Actually, maybe I'm not. Globally, it's possible that the numbers of atheists as a percentage of the global population is rising all the time. I digress. I love what the seed Ray put in my head, to take this. I agree, though, with John. I have to say I agree with John, what he was just saying about how all of these small things that we all do instinctively every day do amount to something. Just because we haven't changed the policies of the Antony Blinkens or of, you know, the Department of Justice in the United States or the High Court in London doesn't mean... that we are having no effect. We are having an effect. And so John's absolutely right about that. I, however, am going to run with the baton that Ray McGovern handed me in the middle of this meeting of the idea of young people and the internet. I'm going to talk to, I know one or two young people and who are very involved in this kind of thinking. And I'm going to go to them and say, hey, I was having this chat with some of the men and women, you know, in the Free Assange movement. How can we get this, insinuate this into the minds of the people that Craig talks to in the universities, who look at him blankly going, where's the rock? You know, because I take his point entirely. I mean, 19 years, it was what? No, 20 years ago with the invasion of Iraq. Well, I was, when I was 19, it was only, work it out, 20 years since the end of the Second World War. So, I mean, no, it was the middle of the Second World War. So, yeah, all we have to do is keep pushing that rock up that mountain, and eventually, unlike Sisyphus, we will get it to the top, and it will roll down the other side, and successive generations will live in a world where the bleeding hearts have more sway, and where men and women and the human race are kinder to one another, because they're not trying to eat the whole cake, they're trying to share it with one another.
Wow. Well, we can't follow that. I want to thank... You can start playing that, Reggie. This is Raj. I don't know if you remember this concert in Amsterdam. I think it was 2018-19. And I want to thank Alicia Castro, Craig Murray, Ray McGovern, John Shipton, and you, Roger, all for really a dynamic two-hour show. And here it is, Roger Waters, Us and Them, a perfect closing. We'll be right back.
and the previous program was an expanded edition of Live on the Fly with Randy Credico, heard Friday starting at 3 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Before we go into the next program, which happens to be... that out here, which happens to be Max Politics with Ben Max. I just wanted to remind people again.